Robert McNeil's been busy since he retired from the NewsHour. He's done a new television series for PBS, and with co-author William Cran, another companion book. Their first one was called The Story of English. This one's called Do You Speak American? And like its predecessor, the book opens with a map of the regional speech areas of the United States. But this map looks quite a bit different from the old one. Blame it on the internet. Blame it on TV. But American English has lost many of its regional differences in usage and vocabulary.
What remains of the regional differences is pronunciation, and the new maps of regional North American dialects are not based on differences in vocabulary and syntax, but on pronunciation. And the map we print at the beginning of the book, which is called the Atlas of North American English, is derived from different pronunciations.
There's some hope in that, it seems to me, because there is a kind of sad story that you tell of interviewing a Down Easterner who misses the language that he grew up with, the Down East, that Maine accent that we all... We all know of what he's talking about. Mm-hmm. But he says he doesn't hear it anymore.
He doesn't hear it among the kids who are playing with his grandchildren because he lives in a community, South Freeport, Maine, which has become a huge outlet center. It was the place where L.L. Bean was first established.
Yes.
And then it drew, as a magnet, all these other clothing outlets. They're open 24 hours a day. Huge numbers of people have come in to work there and to shop there. And many people can now commute from there to Portland, Maine, or because the Maine Turnpike has been improved, all the way to Boston. And so all sorts of newcomers are coming in, and that is the reason, among the children playing around his grandchildren, he doesn't hear that something is wicked good, as he would say.
And on the other hand, I think here in the Midwest, I have heard someone describe a product as being wicked good.
Maybe he came originally from Maine.
It could well be.
I don't. But some of those, especially coastal dialects down the East Coast, where there have been big changes of population, they are beginning to die. Ever since we did the story of English 20 years ago, in that time, Gullah, as a naturally spoken language, has died out. And in fact, in this series, we replay some of the stuff we recorded 20 years ago because those elderly people have gone now. Same with some of the hillbilly talk in North Carolina, Appalachia.
I believe that the people who produced the Dictionary of American Regional English have found the same sort of thing, that even some of the words they have in early volumes discovered are no longer being used.
Yeah.
Now, there's another side to this, though, and you take it up in Do You Speak American? That's the creation of new dialects, if you will, both Ebonics, and I gather in L.A., some of the Spanglish.
Well, more Chicano, because Spanglish is literally a switching, often within the same sentence, from good Spanish to good English and back and forth. We have an example of a wonderful video host there, a young woman who does this with incredible ease, back and forth. That's Spanglish. Chicano is a dialect of English that when you listen to it casually with our ears, sounds as though they're speaking Spanish, but they aren't. And they don't know how to speak Spanish, these young people, except for a few words. That is a new dialect. Well, it's new. I think it's probably been developing for several decades now as a contact language.
One of the interesting things I thought about that was that there was some effort being expended in the schools to allow that language to continue, not to fight it, but to work with the speakers of it to be able to understand standard English.
Well, that was Black English. That was teaching kids in the fifth grade in Los Angeles the difference between African-American English, or as they called it for simplicity, African-American language, and mainstream American English. And it's a delightful sequence because the kids are so excited by their lessons and so turned on by this game of Jeopardy.
Bilingual Jeopardy,
They're manipulating quite sophisticated concepts. I mean, the teacher, these are only fifth grade kids, the teacher asks them, well, how do you code switch between that, and what is the grammatical feature that's a difference there?
In fact, it would be interesting to me if you would pick if you can pick out an example from the book of the way in which they do that kind of bilingual Jeopardy.
Well, some of the examples would be, my grandpa cook dinner every night. And so the teacher says, which feature is not mainstream American English? And one of the kids says, third person singular. And
the fact that he knows that is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and then the teacher says, well, how do you code switch it into mainstream American English? My grandpa cooks dinner every night. But there's another one where he puts up, we don't have nothing to do. And a boy is very excited to answer, and it's his turn, and he says, we don't have nothing to do. And he thinks he's correcting it by making it in English. He says, oh, I'm so sorry. That's not an accurate translation into mainstream American English. So you're minus 200 points. Big groans from the team. He rolls the dice again, and the team gets another chance. And this time they got it right. We don't have anything to do. More cheers, more points, everything. And I think that's really neat. The one who's running the project, she said, her name is Noma Lemoine, our task is to help move them towards mastery of the language at school in its oral and written form, but to do that in a way where they're not devalued or where they feel denigrated in any way by virtue of their cultural and linguistic differences. And
well, I mean, one of the big questions is whether there isn't a growing split between black English and white English.
Yeah, there is. That is documented by some linguists in Texas who studied the speech of former slaves that, believe it or not, people were able to record in the late 30s and early 40s in this part of Texas. Workers from the Works Progress Administration recorded these people. Now, modern linguists, led by a man called Guy Bailey of the University of Texas at San Antonio, have analyzed the speech of those people and found two things. One is, it's remarkably like the speech of whites of that time and place. The other is that it has an absence of many of the markers for inner-city African-American speech today. For instance, the absence of the past tense marker ED, the invariant B, as they call it, I be working, meaning I'm in the habit of working, the absence of the auxiliary verb in he is going, he working, and many other features that are present today in inner-city African-American speech that were not present before the great move to the North.
Or suggests a number of influences.
Well, it suggests language changes and alters and becomes a different dialect when people are separated, when the communication is poor between them. And so Bailey reads into this that after the move north, when blacks effectively found themselves more segregated than in the South and in ghettos, where they also created their own kind of distinctive and alternative culture, language became part of it.
How does language change?
That is still a mysterious process. There are, at any one time, just take America, there are different pronunciations of the same words within a region or a city. And some pronunciations are thought to have prestige at that time, social prestige, and others are not. The theorists believe, for instance, the linguist, very distinguished linguist, William Leboff in Philadelphia, believes that women lead the change. That women, because they were denied traditional sources of power, took power, symbolic power, from language. And because they talked more among themselves and were more sensitive to nuances of language patterns in the social stratum just immediately above them and below them, very much more sensitive than men, they were more sensitive to changes in pronunciation and whatever that might convey socially, and were at least a generation ahead of men in adopting or not adopting various changes. They make parallels between fashion and language. All young women are alive to novelty and fashion. Some young women in a group will have the confidence to adopt the novelty immediately and may have the prestige within her group to persuade other people to adopt it too. And so Leboff sees parallels with women, often in a kind of middle working class level, who are confident of their own social position and are a bit nonconformist and will pick up an alternative pronunciation just because they enjoy it and just for the hell of it and to be nonconformist.
It just makes me sit here and wonder whether we're all going to be like Way Cool in the future.
Well, yeah. I mean, the last line of the book is, and like, how cool is that?
Robert McNeil is the co-author with William Cran of Do You Speak American? There's also a PBS series by the same title.